Hey everyone, I'm Rod Roddenberry, and you're listening to Trek FM.
Hello, and welcome to episode 2 of Stage 9, our new show about the people who make Star Trek. I'm Mike.
I'm John.
And we are here today for our second episode after our rather eventful first episode. We've got a great interview today with David Mack, who is a Deep Space Nine writer who everyone knows and loves. And we're going to talk to him in a little bit. But first, we've got some news.
Yeah. Some cool news, man.
Some very cool news, because the news broke because of our first episode. How cool is that?
That's right.
Last week we talked about the writing staff for the new Star Trek show that Brian Fuller is running, and we profiled each of the writers that we knew about. And someone from the writing staff, Kemp Powers, apparently listened to the show. Yes, thank you very much.
Yeah.
He tweeted us and he said, you know, thanks for the love, but you forgot two people. Aaron Colite, I hope I'm pronouncing that right.
And I hope you are too.
And Joe Manosky, neither of which we knew about. Now we know. And I'm so happy that we know. And, you know, before we recorded last week's episode, I was like, I really hope that there's no one else who we haven't known about. And I was searching the internet furiously for more info because, you know, it's kind of hard to come by. And, you know, lots of these things were just kind of out there and in random places. And, you know, we had to put them all together. And I'm like, man, I really hope there's no one else. I really hope there's no one else. Well, there are two other people. And now I'm really glad that there were two more people because these two names are really, really cool.
They are.
So
they are very cool.
Yes. So as promised, let's take a look at the two newest writers in the Star Trek franchise, Aaron Colite, which again, I hope I'm pronouncing right, and Joe Manosky. Now, Aaron Colite, he is new to the franchise completely. He is someone who worked with Brian Fuller on Heroes. There's a lot of people who worked with Brian Fuller on Heroes.
Yeah.
Did you watch Heroes?
No, I didn't. I never got caught up in that craze, but I know tons of people that loved it.
Yeah, me too. I live with a person who loved it, my wife, and because she watched it religiously, I have probably seen most of it out of the corner of my eye while doing something else. But I've never actually sat down to watch the whole thing. And the more people that are added to this team, the more it becomes clear that I am going to have to watch it. Because everyone worked on Heroes, you know, including Aaron Colite. And he also worked on a few other shows prior to this, or prior to Heroes. His first show was Crossing Jordan, which was from the creator of Heroes, so that makes sense. And then after Heroes, he worked on a show called The River. Did you ever see that?
No, I did not.
I remember when it came out, it was created by the guy who did Paranormal Activity, and it was like, I think, kind of like a supernatural thing. Like,
what? Wow, people. Where did that air? I don't.
I think it was on like ABC or something. Like Bruce Greenwood was in it, I think.
Oh, really? Bruce Greenwood was in it?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, there's okay.
Like if you look at the people involved, it's like huge names. Like, you know, some of the directors that they had were, you know, like A-list people. Like,
Wait a minute. Was that the one where they were on the Amazon like thing? They were like on the Amazon. And they got like all of this weird stuff started happening.
Yeah,
because I think I did watch that show. It was canceled pretty quick, unfortunately.
Yeah,
but I remember my wife and I were totally down with that. Like we were in it from okay. I had forgotten the title of it, but if it's the one I'm thinking of, it was pretty darn cool.
Where it's like a TV crew and they're going down the
Amazon. Yeah, and they're going down the Amazon and then like all of a sudden this weird stuff starts happening and then ABC canceled it.
Yeah, it only lasted 9 episodes, you know, but he was a co-executive producer on that show. Steven Spielberg was a producer on that show. I mean,
yeah, which makes it all the more surprising that they axed it so quick.
Yeah, I guess, you know, ratings talk, right? I mean, that's
ratings.
It's unfortunate.
Such 20th century thinking.
Exactly. Most recently, he worked on a show called Hostages, which I haven't seen. It sounds really cool, and it's actually on Netflix, so I definitely want to check it out. Crossing Jordan, his first show, is also on Netflix. But, you know, another thing that he did, which is not TV-related, was a run on Ultimate X-Men, the comic book. And yeah. I've been on sort of an X-Men kick lately, like with the new movie coming out. I sat down and I watched all the movies in order.
All right.
Really, really interesting how a lot of them are a lot better than I thought they were. But, yeah.
No, they've whatever. Aged well, is what you're saying.
Yeah, except for the first one. None of that has anything to do with Aaron Kalit's run on Ultimate X-Men, which
was quite good.
Did you read it?
Yeah, I read a couple of issues. I don't read I don't get an opportunity to read comics as frequently as I would like nowadays, but I was able to catch a little bit of his run on Ultimate X-Men, and I thought it was good.
Yeah, you know, like when I was, you know, reading about him and everything, I was like, oh yeah, I remember hearing that he did that, you know, and I'm like, I should check those out. So I picked up the first, you know, collection, the first story arc, and it was really good. It's like really interesting. They like introduced basically like a mutant steroid kind of thing, and it's revealed that Colossus has been using it because he is so heavy when he turns to metal that he can't like move himself. Yeah. You know,
right?
So he does that, and then like basically there's like a faction of X-Men who decide like we're going to enhance this, and then basically Xavier's like, you can't do that. We have a zero tolerance, you know, drug policy here at this school. You know, we're not going to start injecting all of our, you know, students with drugs, performance enhancing drugs. So it's an interesting story for sure. I definitely recommend checking it out. I think he worked on the book for about a year. So yeah, definitely check that out. And another thing which he was working on, I don't know if this is still happening or not, but he was actually writing the new Twilight Zone movie that Joseph Kaczynski was going to direct.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, man.
I know, right? I so want that to happen. That.
Jeez, man. Kaczynski, he deserves it.
He's so good. He's so good.
He is.
Yeah.
He is.
So hopefully that'll see the light of day. But if it doesn't, we still have all of this television that we can explore before the new show starts.
Yeah.
So the other writer, which was revealed, was Joe Manosky, which this one, I think, just blew everyone's hair back, right?
It does. Well, okay, as a bald man, I find that statement offensive.
Well, but I'm bald too, if it makes you feel any better.
Okay, well, all right, solidarity. But no, like the do we really need to even like describe, like if you're listening to this show, you probably know who Joe Manosky is, right? I mean, I think that's fairly a given.
You know, I don't know that that necessarily is, because I always see him as being sort of like the cult guy, right?
Really?
Like everyone talks about, you know, Ira Stephen Bear and Brannon Braga and Ron Moore and, you know, these like heavy hitters. Like Joe Manosky is a guy who comes in and he has like that weird cult following where people are like, he did Masks. Yeah. He did the one with the clown. Yeah. You know, and he's like the weird, crazy high concept guy, which I love. Darmok, yes, you know?
I remember seeing that when it was aired for the first time, and that completely, as a youth, watching that show completely melted my brain. I was like, that was so cool. Like, it was such a neat episode. You referenced it forever afterward.
It is a really good episode. It's one which is constantly referenced, like you can see on, like, the Babel Conference. Like, people are referencing it all the time. And it's one of those weird high-concept episodes. And From There to Here, we just covered it a few weeks ago, and I was actually on that episode, and unbeknownst to this news, I took the opportunity to talk about Joe Manosky and what a crazy, awesome writer he is, and how he does all sorts of weird things. And he is. I mean, looking at his filmography again here, he worked on Next Gen, Deep Space Nine, and Voyager. He was on staff on Next Gen and Voyager, and I think he did freelance on DS9. The first episode that he ever wrote was Legacy, which is the one on Next Gen where we meet Tasha Yar's sister.
Mm-hmm.
And then he did Darmok, he did Time Zero, The Chase, which is very noteworthy in that it explains why all of the aliens in Star Trek look like humans.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's very, very cool. And then he also did Masks. How can you not forget about Masks?
Everybody remembers Masks. Everybody.
Yes, they do.
It stays with you.
On DS9, he did a couple episodes, including a really early one.
Dramatis Personae.
Dramatis Personae, right? Okay.
Personae.
Okay. That's,
yes.
That was a very good episode. I like that one. And then yep. He also did Rivals, where Quark's arch nemesis comes to the station. And then he did Time's Orphan, which, you know, here's the thing about Joe Manosky that I love, right? He will say, what if we did this? And then you hear that and you think, that is crazy. That is a crazy idea, and it probably won't work, but I want to see it, because if it does work, it's going to be the best thing ever, right? I mean, that's what Darmok is, right?
Yeah, I can only imagine, like, I mean, yes, being in the pitch for that show to be like, really?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, let's see if it, whoa, hey, look, that worked really well.
Yeah, now yeah. People make, like, t-shirts based on that episode and stuff, right?
Yep.
On Voyager, he did a lot of episodes, including weird ones like The Thaw. He also did Living Witness with Brian Fuller, you know,
which is an amazing episode.
It's a great episode, yeah. And he also co-wrote with Brandon Braga a lot of the big, like, two-hour event things that they did, including Scorpion and Year of Hell. And, I mean, here's the thing about that, right? Like, Next Gen has Best of Both Worlds. The original series has City on the Edge of Forever, you know.
Mm-hmm.
With Voyager, there isn't, like, a clear best of all time kind of thing. There isn't a definitive, like, Citizen Kane of Voyager kind of thing. But the two that always get talked about, the two which are always neck and neck with each other, are Year of Hell and Scorpion.
Mm-hmm.
He wrote both of them. That's insanely impressive.
That's pretty good thing to have on the resume there. Yeah.
And
it's pretty slick.
Year of Hell is my favorite episode of Voyager. But yeah, I mean, this guy, he's written some amazing episodes of Star Trek. And
yeah,
I love that he's part of the staff, because he is the high concept, you know, weird, crazy episode guy. And I love that they're bringing someone like that onto this show to make it sci-fi, you know?
Yeah, somebody who can spin an idea just a little bit beyond what you're thinking of.
Right.
You know, yeah, and who also obviously is, I mean, you know, even though they're all roughly the same quote-unquote time period, Next Gen, Deep Space Nine, and Voyager are all Star Trek, but they have very different voices. They have a very different feel to each one. And so, again, it gets back to what we were talking about, where Fuller is assembling people who have a knack for knowing how to communicate with, you know, multiple voices. Like, he's getting somebody like Manosky who, like, you know, like we said, like he does stuff that's a little different. But then he also has been in, you know, he has been in the Star Trek flow and knows what boundaries can really be pushed in such a way that resonate with the fans, you know, or even the casual watchers. Because even somebody who's not like a huge Star Trek fan, if you bring up Darmok and Jalad and Tanagra, they're gonna be like, oh yeah, that one, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. You know, Adam Drozin, who we had on Commentary Trek Stars to talk about Mission Impossible Ghost Protocol. Oh, man, he is the biggest Joe Manosky fan in the world. As soon as I heard that news, I immediately sent him a message. I'm like, Manosky is writing Star Trek! And he sent me something back, which I can't say on the air because he was so happy that he was driven to profanity.
He used more colorful metaphors.
Exactly. So, yeah, I mean, in terms of his non-Star Trek stuff, Manosky worked on The Dead Zone with Michael Piller, you know, which
good
which
show.
We talked about.
Yep. We covered that on Commentary Trek Stars as well.
Yep. And Salem with Brannon Braga, mm-hmm. which we also covered on Commentary Trek Stars. And he also did this sci-fi channel movie, I believe it was, called Anonymous Rex, which I haven't seen, but I've always wanted to see it. Have you heard of this?
No.
Okay.
No, I have not.
So apparently the concept for this movie is that dinosaurs did not go extinct completely. Some of them actually evolved and learned to camouflage themselves in some sort of way. So now they are basically walking amongst us humans in the present day.
That is crazy.
It is crazy.
That is really interesting.
I want to see it so bad. I think we need to cover that at some point on this show because...
Done. Done and done. And I mean done.
I think it's available to stream on like Amazon and stuff like that. So,
okay.
So, yeah.
Sold.
So, okay. Now that we know what the entire writing staff is, let's just go down the list, you know, so that everyone can see. There's 9 people. Brian Fuller, Gretchen Berg, Aaron Harberts, Jesse Alexander, Kirsten Beyer, Aaron Kalit, Joe Manosky, Nicholas Meyer, and Kemp Powers.
Yeah.
There are, like, okay, yeah. I know that there's going to be a thing, obviously, when the entire cast is announced for this new show. And mm-hmm. people are going to look at it, and they're going to be excited, and there are going to be people on there who we know and people who we've never heard of, and people are going to get excited. And I think that, for a lot of people, is when this show is going to become really real for them because they can put a face to mm-hmm. to the project. To me, I'm right there with everyone for that, right? But this list right here, these 9 people, like, this is... the list for me, right? I mean, these are the people who are going to be making the next chapter in Star Trek, you know?
Yeah, all the great lines that you love hearing the characters say come from these people. And they're going to, I mean, like, looking at this list, it really is something where you're like, it's going to be something interesting happening, really interesting happening here.
And looking at these names, these 9 people, I'm kind of blown away because it really feels like this is a team which was assembled by someone who really cares about doing Star Trek for real. I mean, we know that, yes, this was a business decision which was made, right? Because they're launching this thing and that's why we're getting Star Trek and there's a certain, you know, dollar value attached to it and all this other stuff. But then someone at the network was smart enough to say, go make it right. And now they are.
Mm-hmm.
That's just, that's so awesome.
It's nice to feel like the people running the thing care.
Mm-hmm.
It really, that's what it boils down to, is at the end of the day, you read this list and you read everything that's been developing and you're kind of like, wow, they really do care.
Yeah.
They want to get this right.
Yes. So yeah. I'm super excited about this show. I can't wait. Can't wait to see it. There's one other person who's working on this show who we haven't talked about yet that we know about, and that's Mark Worthington, who is the production designer. He is an Emmy-nominated production designer who has worked on Ugly Betty and American Horror Story. He also worked on the pilot for Lost, which...
Yes.
Yeah. I haven't seen Ugly Betty and I haven't seen American Horror Story, but I have seen the pilot for Lost, and that show looks so good, you know?
I did. My wife watched Ugly Betty, and so I sort of, much like, you know, you with your wife, I experienced it sort of out of the corner of my eye, and I can say that the production design was actually really good on that show.
I imagine.
It really fit the tone of the show and what they were going for. It was really, and actually whenever they would switch locations, like each location had a very definite personality when everybody was in it. And I only watched the first season of American Horror Story, just wasn't my druthers, but the problem wasn't the production design. Like it was a beautiful looking show. You know, I'm sure it still is, but back when I watched it, I've really enjoyed that first season. I mean, yeah, the look of it.
I've been dying to watch American Horror Story. I just haven't gotten around to it. But one of the reasons why I've been dying to see it is because every time I see an image from it, it really pops, you know, it just stands out. And, you know, who knows? This is all speculation and everything like that. And maybe it's putting together stuff which doesn't have anything to do with each other. But the fact that he is the production designer on an anthology series, which changes from season to season, mm-hmm. may suggest that the rumors are true and this show is going to change from season to season. Who knows? You know?
Well, I mean, and look at American Horror Story. Even though it's an anthology show and it changes from season to season, there's still a signature to it mm-hmm. that makes it visually identifiable.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I'm just sort of like following up that point with like, if they did go down that road, they still want people to be able to look at it and say, that's Star Trek. I know what that is.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. All right. So now on to our main feature for this week. This week we're going to be joined by David Mack. Now, okay, we've spoken to David in the past on Commentary Trek Stars, but this morning at like 5 o'clock in the morning, I was driving my wife to work, and both of us were half dead and driving down the expressway, and she says, "Who are you talking to tonight?" And I'm like, "I'm talking to a guy who wrote some Deep Space Nine." And she's like, "Oh yeah, what did he write?" And I'm like, "He wrote It's Only a Paper Moon." And she's like, "What?" And I'm like, "What?" And she's like, "It's Only a Paper Moon." I'm like, "Yeah, the Nog episode. Yes. Do you know how good that episode is?" And I'm like, "Yes, I'm fully aware. I've seen It's Only a Paper Moon. I know exactly how good. Like, they don't make TV like that anymore. They never did." And I'm like, "Yes, I'm fully aware." And, you know, here's the thing. She's right, as per usual. It is, like, one of the best episodes of Star Trek. And, yeah, everyone, you know, I think, tends to think of David as being, you know, the writer of so many Star Trek novels because he's written a billion of them. But he did also write a couple episodes of Deep Space Nine, which were fantastic.
Yeah.
In addition to an original novel called The Calling, which we talked to him about over on Commentary Trek Stars, and you can check that out. Well, he's got two new short stories, which just came out recently in two separate collections. One is called Our Possible Pasts, which is from the book 2113, which is a collection of short stories based on Rush songs. And the other one is Midnight Rider, which is from the book Out of Tune, Volume 2, which is short stories based on ballads. And he sat down to talk to us about both of those stories. This week, we are going to run the portion of the interview in which we discussed Our Possible Pasts, and then next week we will run the second half of the interview in which we discuss Midnight Rider. So here's part one. So you've got two new short stories coming out, which are interesting in that they're very different stories, but they're kind of similar thematically in that they're both based on music to some degree or another.
Yeah, it was an interesting coincidence. I was invited to participate in these two very different anthologies within a short span of time, maybe a month or two. And what happened was the first one to approach me was the Rush anthology, which came out on April 12th of this year, I think. And that was edited by Kevin J. Anderson and David McFetridge. And it's called 2113 Stories Inspired by the Music of Rush. So I was approached by them first, and Kevin had actually been setting the wheels in motion on this for a long time, sort of getting a show of hands from authors to see who was interested. And I was one of the first to go, me, me, me. So I wrote my story for that. I'd had an idea that I'd been tinkering with for a long time, and it just happened to be a perfect fit for the anthology. And as I was working on that, I was approached by Jonathan Mayberry, who was editing a second volume of an anthology series he does called Out of Tune. And the concept behind Out of Tune is classic English, Irish, Scottish folk ballads, usually from anywhere from like the 17th through the 19th century, being used to inspire new fiction pieces by a variety of authors, some of them noted authors of fantasy, some of them science fiction, some of them mystery writers, some of them well-known as horror writers. And a friend of mine, Keith DeCandido, contributed to the first anthology. And off of Keith's recommendation, Jonathan approached me and said, well, here's the idea, and here's a link to some of the ballads. And I said, well, I really don't know much about them, but I'm intrigued to learn, and I think it's a really cool idea for an anthology. So I looked into it, and at first I thought, well, this really seems to be outside my area of expertise. It's outside of my wheelhouse, if you will. But the more I thought about it, the more I realized that was exactly the reason to do it. So I went through and I read a whole bunch of these old ballads, and I finally selected one called The Suffolk Miracle, and I saw potential in it. I saw that the original folk ballad, as it were, had some really interesting and creepy elements, but I didn't like the ending. I thought that its ending was unsatisfying, and I thought it was dramatically not really an appropriate payoff. But I thought, well, if I was going to rewrite it, what would I do with it? What would be the appropriate ending? And once I realized where it needed to go dramatically, narratively, I then transposed it from this, tale from the old English countryside of the 18th century into a tale from the Old West near the end of the 19th century set in North Texas. And I basically turned it into a story of love denied, love betrayed, and love avenged.
Let's start with the Rush one, the one from 2113, which is called Our Possible Pasts. This was based on a song by Rush, Show Don't Tell. And how did you go about, I guess the first question is, which I think we probably know the answer to, is you're a Rush fan?
Oh, lifelong. Well, I wouldn't say lifelong. I came to Rush as a fan probably around the age of 12, I guess, maybe around 11 or 12, 1980, 1981, somewhere in that range, around the time of their Permanent Waves LP, Moving Pictures. And I've been to every Rush concert tour since Signals in 1982.
Cool.
I've seen Rush live about 30, 35 times, which is, not much for, diehard Rush fans, but it was all I could afford. I never had the time or the financial luxury to travel around and follow the band. And I've had the privilege of meeting two-thirds of the band. I've met Getty and I've met Alex. I got to hang out with them backstage at the PNC Bank Arts Center after a show on the Snakes and Arrows tour back in 2007. So that was very cool. And I've actually received an email once from Neil Peart. I had given a gift of some books that I had inscribed for him and had autographed. And I'd left them with Getty and Alex after I met them, and they gave them to Neil. And Neil sort of checked my bona fides with Kevin J. Anderson, who vouched for me. And so I got a nice thank you email from Neil Peart. And, for someone like me, that's like getting an email from God. some people have religion. I have Rush, except that my gods have apparently retired. So there you go. Anyway. But yes, very big Rush fan. And so when I was approached about the anthology a couple years back, I was very excited about the idea. And the idea for this story, Our Possible Past, which can be described as it's a time travel narrative in the form of a courtroom drama. Essentially, a woman claims that she has invented a way to transmit a person's memory and consciousness back in time to their younger self. The first catch is that once you go back, you skew off into a new quantum branching timeline so that you're basically writing a new future on a parallel timeline to the one you left. And it's hard to predict where it's going to go from there. The second catch is that your body in the present, in the course of this machine that she has invented, the psychotemporal transmitter, as it reads the electrochemical information in your brain, sort of the way a tape head reads the signal off of a tape cassette and turns it into an analog signal to transmit, the machine in the process wipes your brain clean and leaves your body basically brain dead and fried. So it's one of these things where you kind of have to take it on faith because there's no way to prove it. There's no way to get a message back from one of these alternate quantum timelines. And so as a result, the people who tend to make use of this machine, the people who this woman courts as her clients, tend to be the terminally ill, the bereaved, those who have lost their loved ones, their families, their spouses, who are nearing the end of their lives and either want a chance to live it all again, which would be a reference to a Rush song that I did not put into my story, or simply a chance to go back and do things differently and see what might have been. And the whole story is done from first person present tense point of view of a man named Juan Robles, who has been tasked with prosecuting this woman and securing a death penalty conviction against her. And the problem that is plaguing his conscience is that he learned just enough science in college to suspect that she's telling the truth and that she doesn't actually deserve to die, but it's his job to make sure she does.
I want to say that I think that one of the most interesting aspects of it is, as the story is nearing the end, is he gets so caught up in the prosecution that he actually loses sight of the fact that he doesn't feel that she deserves the punishment. Like, I think you do a really excellent job of illustrating how easy it is for somebody in a competitive situation to get caught up in the goal and forget that there are, you know, they might even be torn about something. I thought that was a really fascinating angle to the character.
Well, it seems to me that anybody who would become a prosecutor, an assistant U.S. attorney at that level of the game has to have some sort of a competitive streak, a mean streak, if you will, that allows them to win and overcome sympathy. But he does catch himself and wonder, you know, why am I fighting so hard? I didn't think she deserved this in the first place. But one of the fun things about this project is that although the song that is cited as the inspiration for the story in the table of contents is Show Don't Tell, which is a very well-known Rush song off of the Presto album, it's basically a lot of, you know, turns of phrase that relate to courtroom procedure. The other song that is not cited, which in many ways was the more potent inspiration for the song, for the story, was off of the first album, off of Rush's eponymous first CD, for which Getty wrote the lyrics. And it was a song called Here Again. Oh. And if you were to go through the lyrics to that song, you would totally see, oh my God, yes, this could easily have inspired A Tale of Time Travel. But at the end of the day, I was only allowed to cite one of the two songs as inspiration because that was the format for the book. And Kevin and I agreed that Show Don't Tell was a more recognizable track, one that would be more easily identified and relatable for Rush fans. But the lyrics on Here Again, the first couple of lines are, you know, I said I played this song so many times before that the melody keeps repeating. And I thought, wow, that sounds like somebody who's going and reliving the life that they've already lived. And I you know, there's other lyrics from later in the song. Yes, I've seen your face before. Why, I've seen it everywhere. So I'm looking at this song, and I really wish I could have cited that one, but Show Don't Tell just made more sense because it seemed to fit the conceit of the story better as a courtroom drama.
This is definitely a science fiction story, but it's one of those, I think, cool science fiction stories which almost could take place in the present day. I mean, there's no reason why it really couldn't, because the tech, which is sort of at the heart of the story, is something which is questionable as to whether or not it actually is a real thing. I like that. Why did you choose to set it slightly in the future. I don't know if I'm maybe forgetting something in the story, but I'm just curious about the decision there.
The decision making on that, originally I was torn between setting it present day or setting it in the future. And eventually I decided that a wormhole generator in something that compact had to be a little bit futuristic. It had to be a bit ahead of where we are now, because although the concept of being able to read people's thoughts by means of an electromagnetic field that stimulates synaptic activity, that's within our reach right now. The ability to open a pinhole wormhole and transmit that data as an analog signal, and the ability to, for instance, identify someone's chronotemporal signature as a four-point, Cartesian map of their movement through space-time. It sounds really great on paper, and it allows me to, dodge a lot of tricky gotcha questions from readers, but I never really explain how that works. That's kind of a little bit of hand-wavium in the middle of the story. So I felt that a futuristic setting served to underscore the plausibility of the machine itself. And then it enabled me to just add little details like, the holographic emitter in his eyepiece. And I just feel like it sets it far enough ahead. And by not specifying the year or how many years ahead of it, ahead of where we are, I feel like it's the kind of thing that can help the story remain fresh, remain accessible, remain plausible for a long time to come, because I haven't pigeonholed it into a specific year. And although some of that technology may very well come to pass in the very near future, I'm pretty sure not all of it will. And I think that will continue to allow it to feel like it's in a future that's just slightly out of our grasp, but we can almost feel it coming into grasp.
I like stories like that sort of, because there is that sort of grounded reality to it. You don't have to sort of worry about the entire world being built. You can just kind of jump in and get to the heart of what the story is really about, which seems really beneficial for when you're working in a short, medium like this.
Yeah, that was also part of the consideration too, is that I didn't want to have to spend so much time on the world building that it interfered with getting to know the characters and the narrative. I wanted to be able to drive right into the story, and by grounding it in a more familiar near future setting, one where we still have things like scotch and cigarettes and courtrooms, but where we also have things like the holographic emitters on the eyeglasses and an automated AI stenographer in the courtroom and a psychotemporal transmitter, it seemed like the best of both worlds in that regard.
How did you go about choosing the songs to base the story on? I mean, I know that there's a couple, but like, did you have a story in mind already, or did you listen to a bunch of music and see what jumped out to you, or was there one that came to your head right away? I mean, how did that work?
Well, Our Possible Past is a story that before I wrote it had been kicking around inside my head for a couple of years. I'd been thinking about it off and on, pondering at night as I would lie in bed waiting to go to sleep. I would think about the story, because one of the things that always bugged me about time travel stories were the paradoxes, the problems of temporal mechanics, and I wanted to try and write a time travel story that I thought could be plausible within the bounds of temporal mechanics as they're currently understood. The other thing was that when I was first approached on the Rush anthology, I tried so hard to conceive of something else. I thought I would save Our Possible Pasts and submit it to, the magazines like Clark's World or Lightspeed or Asimov's or Amazing Stories or something like that. And I tried to force a story out of my head based on the song Driven. And no matter how hard I tried, I could not come up with a story based on Driven that A, I gave a damn about, or B, was short enough to fit the format that I'd been given. If I could you know, have written a whole, if I had time and the energy to write a whole novel based on Driven, well, then yes, I could definitely do something with Driven. But in a short story format, the more I tinkered with it, the more I realized that's just not coming together for me. And I knew that a number of the other really well-known Rush songs had been spoken for. And some of the ones that evoked the clearest stories for me were also the ones where the story is clearly told in the song itself. And I'm like, well, then it doesn't need me telling it again. So I ruled out, for instance, The Body Electric and a couple of others. What eventually happened was I came back around to our possible pasts and I realized that this story had been obsessing me for years and that there was a really good opportunity to connect it to the Rush anthology. So I went back and I listened to pretty much my entire, you know, Rush collection again, thinking about which songs seemed to speak to the themes in that story. And that was how I found Here Again off the first album. And then I thought about the courtroom aspects, connecting it to Show Don't Tell. So I actually started with the story. I've had the story brewing in my head for a long time, but I eventually realized it was a beautiful fit for this project, and it turned out to be the right fit.
There are a lot of very interesting themes that I think you explore in this story. And I pulled a couple out that, you know, obviously it's open to reader's interpretation, but if there's a singular message buried in it that you would hope somebody would pull away, what would it be?
I think that it's better to act in hope than to give in to despair and do nothing.
Okay. Yeah. Because I had actually written down, I thought it was a beautiful line you had written, better to die in hope than live in fear. That instantly popped to me. And I wrote it down at that exact moment that I encountered it. That was a really beautiful line.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
I wanted to ask you about the ending, but I'm not going to because I don't want to ruin it for anyone. But I'm very
well. We could just say spoilers and tell people, you know, skip ahead.
I guess so. I don't know. I'll leave it up to you because.
But is there some way you can ask about the ending without spoiling the ending?
Okay, this is what I'll say, and if you think it's too spoilery, I'll cut it out. The ending is not as ambiguous as I thought it would be. And I'm wondering why you chose to, I guess, be as specific as you were.
It's interesting you should mention that. The original approach I took to the ending was ambiguous. I was going to leave it at sort of the moment just before where I eventually ended up ending it and leaving it to the reader to wonder at the outcome. And I tried that. I tried writing that ending. I tried making that ending work. And eventually, I think I realized at some point that it was a cop-out. And that if I was going to choose as my song inspiration, Show Don't Tell, well, then this was a pretty good time to show not tell. And I realized that at the end of the day, although ambiguity has its place and the whole question of, you know, it's sort of like a Lady and the Tiger story where the whole thing is to leave the question unanswered because the answer is something that the reader discovers about themselves. I realized this is actually not that kind of story, that if you look at the final exchange between Gwen Anfang and Juan Robles, there is definitely a theme, as John and I just discussed, which is that it's better to die in hope than to live in fear. And I realized that at some point, choosing to try and embrace an ambiguous ending or an undefined ending was a narrative cop-out on my part. And I finally just had to say, what do I want this ending to be? Do I want this all to have been in vain? Do I want to be a nihilist? Or do I want to embrace hope? And I decided to just make a choice and go with it. And so that's what I did.
All right. Well, that was really fun talking to David about.
Yeah, it was. I really enjoyed that. In case it didn't come across clearly enough, highly recommend his work in 2113. and Out of Tune Volume 2. Both great stories.
Yeah, they were. They were, both of them, especially the one in 2113.
Yeah.
I can't really stop thinking about it. It's such a great sci-fi concept, and it's told in such a perfect way, you know?
Yeah.
It reminds me of, like, Philip K. Dick, you know? Like, Minority Report and that kind of thing. That sort of, like, grounded reality, and I don't know. It's just, it gives you a lot to think about philosophically, as well as being, like, really interesting in terms of its science fiction concepts.
Yeah, it's really thought-provoking. It's certain, yeah. Definitely agree.
So, yeah, definitely check those out, you know. And there's a bunch of other short stories in those books, too, by a lot of familiar writers, you know, people like Dayton Ward and stuff like that. So definitely check out those two books. The books are 2113 and Out of Tune, Volume 2. And you can get them on Kindle and everything like that. You can even get 2113 on Audible. So definitely check it out.
Yeah.
All right. Well, it was fun talking to David today, but that's not all we're talking about here on Trek FM this week. So here's a look at what you can find elsewhere on the network.
Previously on Trek.fm, The Orb.
Ducat is only good at one thing, and that is trying to make Ducat look good. But really, he's kind of, you know, the kid eating paste in the back of the class. That's Ducat.
Literary Treks.
And then I've also seen some of the animated series that came out some years ago. I didn't watch the whole series, but I occasionally would watch that with my daughter because she was really into it. So I had I'm somewhat familiar with Legion of Superheroes. And plus, they were in an episode of Smallville. I remember that, too. So
yeah.
That's about the extent for me.
Meta Treks.
I can't imagine a more Klingon-sounding phrase than that. You know, if you think that euthanasia doesn't necessarily mean compassion, it means a good death, right? You can imagine euthanasia being yelled out by a Klingon. Euthanasia! Sounds Klingon to me.
Today is a good day for euthanasia.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
So check out these shows and find out what we're talking about in your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe and beyond. You'll find us wherever you get your podcasts. Apple, iTunes, you know, Stitcher, all those places. If you are an Apple user, be sure to hit the subscribe button on iTunes. Leave us a review. Let us know what you think. It not only does it help us out in terms of, you know, feedback, but it also helps us out in terms of getting the word out about the show and making sure that other people know that we exist and can listen. So yeah, definitely, please help us out there.
Yeah.
Another way that you could help us out is becoming a patron of the network on Patreon. And I have to say, I was kind of blown away by the fact that we already have an associate producer who came on board before our first episode even aired. And his name is Jeff Sutter. And he, I guess, listened to commentary Trek Stars. He said that he liked it quite a bit and that he was, you know, a fan of us and that he wanted to help us out. So he's an associate producer on the show. I am so honored by that. I think both of us
are. We're incredibly grateful and humbled and you know, thank you. I mean, more than anything, for the vote of confidence in us. And we really do appreciate it wholeheartedly. Really, thank you. Thank you very much.
Absolutely. And I really hope that we don't let you down. I hope you've been liking the show. Thank you again, Jeff. And if you want to be like Jeff, and who doesn't want to be like Jeff? Jeff
seems Everybody
like
wants
a really
to be
cool,
like Jeff.
Yeah, he seems like a really cool guy, right? You can become a patron of the network. If you just go to patreon.com/trekfm, you can find a list of all of our goals and donation levels and all that good stuff. And, you know, every little bit helps. So go over there, check it out. If you can, you know, throw us a bit of change, we'd really appreciate it. Just go to patreon.com/trekfm. That's patreon.com/TrekFM. And thanks again, Jeff. We really do appreciate it. Okay. If you want to contact us, you can email us at comtrackstars@gmail.com, or you can find us on the Babel Conference. Just type B-A-B-E-L, Babel Conference, into the search field on Facebook, and we'll come up. That's our listener forum, where people can discuss our shows and various other topics related to our shows, and tell us what you think. Tell us what, have you read? Someone on there actually started a thread about the 2113.
Wow.
And Dayton Ward was actually on there talking about it too. So, you know, let us know what you think. Read the books. Tell us what you think about them. Tell us what you think about David's work on Deep Space Nine and how awesome his two episodes are and everything like that. Just go there and talk to us about whatever you want. John, where can people find you on the internet?
On Twitter, I'm Kessel Junkie, the aforementioned Babel Conference. And you can also find me on Words with Nerds with my pal Craig. And you can find me on Aggressive Negotiations, a Star Wars podcast that I co-host over on the Nerd Party Network with Trek FM's own Matthew Rushing.
And you can find me on Twitter at Mumbles3K and also producing and occasionally appearing on From There to Here, Trek FM's daily rewatch of Star Trek for the 50th anniversary, in which we look at all 729 episodes from beginning to end. And you can find the network on Twitter at Trek FM. Okay, so we will pick this back up next week with the second half of our interview with David Mack, in which he will tell us everything there is to know about his other short story, Midnight Rider, which you can find in Volume 2 of the Out of Tune series.